Blog Talk Radio.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go and what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
For African people, nothing important happens without a libation. And so for this very important presentation, we begin by the pouring of libation. We pour libation first to our first ancestor, to that hidden one who, though hidden, manifests in all things as all things, that God goddess idea in the universe by any and all names. To our first ancestor, we pour libation, Ashe. We pour libation too to our ancestors because they were the first people on this planet, mothers and fathers of all mankind, flashpoint of the human family. To those ancestors we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to our ancestors because they were the ones who first gave birth to the idea of civilization, knew we would need a form of governance, and they nurtured that idea along the Nile until it reached its zenith in Kemet. There they built these gigantic monuments as evidence of that great civilization, and they carved instructions on the walls of temples and tombs for us so we would never forget. To those ancestors we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to our ancestors because over time they put together all the tenets of civilization and they took those ideas and left the continent. They were the people of the first Exodus. They left Africa and went all over the world and peopled the world. To those ancestors we pour libation, Ashe. We pour libation too to our ancestors because they did not sit on their laurels. They continued to improve, continued to evolve, and at each point of evolution, they again would leave the continent and settle and resettle the planet. They met themselves coming and going. To those ancestors we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to those ancestors because over time, they found themselves the object of a forced exodus. When they were kidnapped, shackled, cargoed, shipped out of Africa and enslaved in diasporas around the world. To those ancestors we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to the ancestors left at home, the very young, the aged, the infirm, left to reinvent themselves, depleted of us, human resources. But they were enjoined by us in the diasporas, both objects of a global myopia that ruptured the soul of a people as it ravaged a continent. To those ancestors we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to those ancestors because over time they began to remember who and what they were. Because no matter where they had been dropped off, they still retained bits and pieces of who and what they were. They retained that African core that describes them. They began to remember bits and pieces of a song. They began to remember lines from a rhythm. They began to remember dances that they did in ancient times. They began to remember those ancient drum beats that they now beat out on bare skin. And so to those ancestors we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to them because they then began to teach each other. They began to resurrect and reconstruct that history and that culture. They became the new Africans wherever they were. They became the new teachers, preachers, archaeologists. The new singers, dancers, the new drummers, the new Jalia. They reconstructed that history and our culture and became new Africans everywhere. So to those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation to those ancestors because they are the ones who passed that information on to us. And so we pour libation to those of you who will watch this presentation. Those of you who are the recipients of that pieced together history, of that reconstructed culture. To you, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to our children and those yet to be born. For they are the ones that you must teach. And you can only teach if you know the history. So to you who are learning the history and are passing on that history, and to our children who are learning that history and will pass that history on to all eternity, but they will call your name in all eternity. To our children we pour libation. Ashe. Ashe. Asheo.
Listening to Warriors Way Radio, where their motto is continuing the fight. Your host is Brother Kwasi Kraft. Warriors Way Radio is an affiliate of the Sankofa Historical Society, which is a part of the Black Reality Think Tank, and they are operating on the Block Talk Radio Network. Check them out. Email them at warriorsway101@gmail.com. All of our programs are archived. Just go to www.blogtalkradio.com. Go to the search portal, put in the Sankofa Historical Society, and check out any of our programs that are there. They air every Thursday evening. 6 o'clock, Warriors Way Radio, continuing the fight.
Hotel family, it's your brother Kwasi Kraft, Shujai Kowatu. The warrior for the people. Welcome for another broadcast. We're going to do a continuation from last week, and hopefully we should have a guest. Brother Osi, a former firefighter, should be joining us shortly. But again, we're going to talk about first responders turned bad. It's at part two. And I'm just going to give you a little more information on some of the things that we're talking about the week before, because some other things have developed since then. And so it is just a continuous fight and struggle for us in so many shapes and ways, and, you know, the way they come at us. So that is just something to be thought about. And before I go any further, we're going to do our ancestral profile. And ancestral profile is going to be on Eartha Kitt. And Kitt is Eartha Mae Kitt. Keith actually was the name she was born with. And she was born on a cotton plantation near a small town north in South Carolina, or St. Matthews, on January 17th, 1927. Now, her mother, Annie Mae Keith, was of Cherokee and African descent. Now, though she had little knowledge of her father, it was reported that he was the son of the owner of the farm where she had been born, and that Kitt was conceived by rape. Now, in a biography in 2013, a British journalist, John Williams, claimed that Kitt's father was a white man, a local doctor named Dr. Strokey. Now, Kit's daughter, McDonald Shapiro, was questioning the accuracy of the claims. Now, Eartha's mother, Annie Mae Keith, later Annie Mae Riley, soon went on to live with a black man who refused to accept Eartha Kitt because of her relatively pale complexion. And she was raised by a relative named Aunt Rosa. In those households, she was abused. And after the death of Annie Mae, Eartha was sent to live with another relative named Mamie Kitt, who in fact, may have been her biological mother in Harlem, New York, where she attended a Metropolitan Vocational High School, later renamed the School of the Performing Arts. Now, Eartha Kitt, she was an advocate and a very outspoken person, and I'm just going to jump ahead. There was an incident with her in the White House, and this is during the administration of, in 1968, during the Lyndon B. Johnson administration. Now, Kitt encountered a substantial professional background after she made the anti-war statements during the White House luncheon. Now, Kitt was asked by the First Lady Bird Johnson about the Vietnam War. She replied, "You send the best of our country off to be shot and maimed. No wonder the kids rebel and take pot. Now, during that question and answer session, Kitt stated, "The children of America are not rebelling for no reason. They are not hippies for no reason at all. We don't have what we have on Sunset Boulevard for no reason. They are rebelling against something. There are so many things burning the people of this country, particularly the mothers. They feel that they are going to raise sons, and I know what it's like, and you have children of your own, Mrs. Johnson. We raise them and send them to war." Now, her remarks caused Mrs. Johnson to burst out in tears. So that was basically the kind of the sabotage of her career. After that, it was very hard for her to get jobs. But she, some things about Eartha Kitt, she singer, dancer. She played in several movies and other films. And she, like I said, she was an activist, and I'm just going to jump into in the 80s. In 1984, she returned to music charts with a disco song titled "Where Is My Man," the first certified gold record of her career. "Where Is My Man" reached the top 40 in the UK singles chart, where it peaked to number 36. The song became standard in discos and dance clubs of the time and made it to the top 10 of the U.S. Billboard chart, where she reached number 7. The single was followed by the album "I Love Men" and on the Record Shack label. Kitt found new audiences in nightclubs in the U.K. and the United States, including new generations of gay male fans, and responded by frequently giving benefit performances in support of HIV and AIDS organizations. Now, in 1989, a follow-up hit, "Cha-Cha Heels," featuring Bronski Beat, which was originally intended by Records Divine, received a positive response from UK dance clubs, reaching number 32 in the charts in the country. In 1988, Kitt replaced Doris Gray in the West End production Stephen Sondheim's Folly as Carlita, and receiving standing ovations every night for her rendition of "I'm Still Here." And at the beginning of Act Two, she went out to perform a one-on-one woman show at the Shaftesbury Theater, a sold-out houses for 3 weeks in 1989. So she was, and she also spoke several languages. She, German, French, and she sang in 11 different languages. And so she was very adaptable and just very talented. She did have a daughter, and her daughter is still around. And her daughter was identified. She's identified as a white female, and she has blonde hair, and her skin complexion is that of a white woman. And so, and that was her natural. And her, her one of her husbands was white. Now, Kit died of colon cancer Christmas Day in 2008, 3 weeks short of her 82nd birthday at her home in Westport, Connecticut. Her daughter, Kit McDonald, described her last days with her mother. I was with her when she died. She left this world literally screaming at the top of her lungs. I was with her constantly. She lived not even 3 miles from my house. We were together practically every day. She was home for the last few weeks when the doctor told us there was nothing they could do anymore. Up until the last 2 days, she was still moving around. The doctor told us she would be leaving us very quickly and her body would just start to shut down. But when she left the world with a big bang. She left it how she lived it. She screamed her way out of here, literally. And I truly believe her survival instincts were so part of the DNA days that she was that she was not willing to go quietly. It was the last, it was just the two of us hanging out during that last days. She was very funny. We didn't have to talk, because I always knew what she felt, how she felt about me. I was the love of her life. So that last part of her life, we didn't have to have this heart-to-heart talk. She started to see people the way they were. She thought I could see them too, but of course I couldn't, and I would make fun of her like that. I'm going to go in the other room and you just stay here and talk to your friends. And so that was her goodbye to her mother. It should be also known that she got a Primetime Emmy Award for Outstanding Actress in the limited series I Spy. That was in 1966. She also got the Tony Award for Best Actress in a Musical, and that was Timbuktu. And that was 1978. In 2000, Best Featured Actress in a Musical, The Wild Party, 2007. And then 2008, a Daytime Emmy Award, Outstanding Performer Animated Program, The Emperor's New School. And in 2010, another Daytime Emmy on the Wonder Pet. And that's Save the Cool Cat and the Hip Hippo. So she was a very active person, and, you know, we just give much respect for her. And she also spoke, you know, when she first, when her parents didn't want her, her mother, because of her complexion. And one of the things that there was a bio on her, and she actually, she spoke on it, and she talked about discrimination among ourselves, and where she was discriminated against by her own family and other people that were black people because she was a lighter-skinned black person, so a lot of people didn't want her around, so. You know, I think we're still dealing with some of those social issues now where we judge people differently because they're a darker-skinned black person or someone is a lighter skin. I mean, it just seems that that is just something that we're still dealing with, you know, when we're trying to identify each other. If you're from Jamaica, if you're from, you know, this part of Africa, you know, black from all over, you know, of different shades and so forth. We've always been those people that, you know, our complexion just varies so much, and we seem to have issues with each other as to who is original or should be calling themselves black or whatever. And so based on how we are, you know, discriminated against, and we have the same people that basically are doing it, you know, the white man, and but yet we fight with each other so much on that. So before we get into the first responders turn bad part two, I wanted to read something, and this is about Muhammad Ali. He had made this quote in regards to conversation he was having on why we shouldn't integrate. And you know, he had made some statements earlier during this interview, and he indicated that, you know, you don't find dogs trained to integrate and be with cats. You know, dogs are going to be with other dogs and so forth. You know, they're not going to try to mix and do. And somebody made it, but we're human beings. And he said, well, you don't find, you know, the Chinese integrating with blacks or Arabs, you know, the same thing. And he went on and on, and it's like, we're the only group of people that you're trying to, you know, put in this box and stuff like that, knowing that this is not going to work. And but yet we're constantly trying to force this scenario to work. So anyway, let me go with what he was saying, and this is Muhammad Ali. So now I'm going to forget 400 years of lynching, killing, and raping, and depriving my people, fed of justice, equality, and the lowest of the low, last respect, and I'm going to look at two or three white people who are trying to do right and don't see the other millions who are trying to kill me. Now, I'm not that big a fool. It happens every day, and the rape of our women daily, policemen pull black people over, hit them across the head, and try them unjustly in court, and none of these good white folks can be found to help us. And so what I'm going to tell you is, get up and say Elijah Muhammad is wrong when he says that they are devils. And they have to prove that they are not. And that's Muhammad Ali. So we're talking, I think that was 1967 when he made that comment with the interview he had with a London reporter. And if you're looking at what was being said back then, and you're looking at what's going on right now, we're still dealing with that. Nothing really has changed in regards to some of the things that we're dealing with. I talked about the first responders, and I just wanted to bring attention to something. This young lady, and I've read this before. This incident is not a new incident, but it's just something that happened that just bothered me, and I just want to just put that out in the airwaves, and I'm just wondering how many people may know of this or may not, you know, but there was a young lady that – let me see. her name was, let me get this real quick. Excuse me a second. Okay, a baby dies after an off-duty cop driving 94 miles an hour crashes into her car. Now, this was in 2017. So, again, this is and the mother was charged with negligent homicide. So the mother was charged with negligent homicide. The mother is a black female. She was 21 years old. And the officer that was driving, and he was driving twice, more than twice the speed limit. He was driving his orange Corvette, and he hit the car. They indicated after they reviewed everything, both the lights were green, and that doesn't make sense, that both lights going east and northbound were green. That doesn't make sense, but that's more or less what they said during the trial, so maybe there was some error. But again, you know, the cop shouldn't have been driving at 94 miles an hour. But when he hit her vehicle, her SUV, the baby flew out of the vehicle. And so the police handled that investigation, and this was in Baton Rouge Police Department, and the mother was charged with negligent homicide. So they charged her with negligent homicide, and then later on they stated that they weren't going to charge her, but they couldn't find enough evidence to charge the officer with anything. And until this day, he is still working on that police department. And this is his, I believe, second accident. The young lady, her name was Brittany Steffen, and she was 21 years old. So I don't know what kind of support she may have had in that situation, but this was predominantly a white police department, and the attorney that was trying to help her in this matter indicated that, you know, this whole investigation was handled by local police people, and it seemed pretty apparent to him that they weren't going to do anything, and if they did something, you know, what they initially wanted to do was charge the female, and the baby was in the baby seat, but they indicated that if the baby was secured properly when he hit her car, her vehicle, then the baby wouldn't have flew out and wouldn't have died. And so none of that makes much sense because, again, they're not really talking about how fast the officer was going. They did make a statement in the case indicating that, well, it doesn't make sense. We wouldn't want our officers driving that fast, whether they're on duty or off duty, and it's just sad that something like that happened. But she should have had the baby more secure in the seat. And so just the lack of concern and for the death of a child and the trauma to the mother, and, you know, that just moves me in so many different ways, just thinking, you know, who was there fighting for her, you know? And I understand those situations, not, you know, from a death situation like that, but, you know, I've been involved in situations where I didn't have the money, resources, and I did know some people, but they weren't going to do anything if I didn't have money. And so you run into that a lot. And when people figure out that you don't have that support group or somebody that's just going to come and do something for you because it's the right thing, and more than likely, if they did come in and, you know, they showed that support, it might be handled different, because when they know you got something and they know it's going to have to be dealt with a little different, but that wasn't the case. And so when we get into our topic here about, you know, the firefighters, so I would say I should have Brother Oshie on the line in a little bit. I'm going to look and see. I have someone here, and let me just on. Not getting it. Come on. Just bear with me 1 second here. I'm trying to get him on the line. Hello?
Hello?
Hi, is this Brother Hosey? Hello?
Yes, it is.
Can you hear me?
Okay. I can hear you.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you clear.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so I'm going to talk about, I don't know if you know about the incident with the fire department in New York. You know, this was a number of different things happened. I'm going to take it further back. I'm going to go back to August 4th, 2016. And that's
okay.
Going to be, and it's a small little area in, it's called North Tawanda in New York. But there was a Kenneth Walker, a black firefighter. He a wife, and he's got two children. And he had got a letter sent to him, and this was investigated by the FBI. But it said, black people are not allowed to be firefighters. And you should resign from the position or you'll regret it. And a short time later, his house was burned down. He two pets were in the house, which were his cats. But he and his wife and his two children weren't home during the time, thank God. And so that was something that happened back then. And that was, and I haven't heard anything as far as whether they apprehended somebody that they found out that was involved in that situation. And then when we want to talk about right now, you know, these are our first responders. You got 9 firefighters that were suspended from the New York Fire Department, and this recently, and that's going to be back in September. And that was, they were suspended for racist statements they made during the George Floyd protests and his death. And they wrote a letter, and they made all type of jokes about memes about how he died. And the black firefighters, you know, they got tired of it. And they made some complaints. And it took a while. And some of the firefighters, the black firefighters, were command officers before something was even done then. And then I'm just going to take it, you know, when I'm still talking about first responders in Washington, D.C., you have 10 women. And they have a lawsuit for $100 million. With their department, and that department, the women were harassed, and they were getting in trouble. And we're talking about from command officers to just regular patrol officers, and some of the things that these men did to the women just to show total disrespect. Was, you know, just didn't make any sense. But like one of the women, she talked about that she went to one of the males, he urinated while she was in the squad car with him. He took a container and, you know, just started urinating. Another woman made a complaint. And this woman, I could give you their names. By Brinkley, Akia Mitchell, Regina Greer, Tabitha Knight, and they say that they were forced to leave the police department because they made complaints. And one of the women, She had made a complaint after one of the officers had grabbed her by the butt. Another officer had, she observed, walk up to a black female officer and stick his tongue in her mouth. So they were doing all these type of things. And I know, you were with the fire department here in Milwaukee.
Yeah.
And so I know quite a few firefighters, a lot of people, and there's a strong relationship with the fire and police department because, and when I say that, when Chief Jones became the chief in Milwaukee, a lot of the Milwaukee police officers, didn't want to work for Jones. And so because they were city workers, they were able to transfer over and go directly to the fire department. And you retired from the fire department, so you put in some time. Have you witnessed, how was it when you were working there? Did they have to make some different adjustments because of the number of blacks that were on there? Because the fire department of New York, they said that they have about 11,000, just a little over 11,000, but 75% of the officers are white. And so they're trying to get some more diversity and stuff like that. What's it like here with Milwaukee when you were there?
Well, when I came on back in the 70s, the middle 70s, the department was 1,100-man department. And I think we reached a high of about 170 American-African firefighters. And we had at least about 12 women. And then since that time, the numbers have been going down ever since. And, of course, the department has downsized as well from 1,100 now to 800. But now we only have 80. We only have 80 American-African firefighters. You're talking about less than 10%. But American-Africans, we comprise of over 40% of the city's population.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that's systemic nationwide. You know, the fire department, unlike the police department, when, those municipalities were willing to hire some brothers, more than likely, to become police officers so they would police our community. You know, but firefighters, there was always a reluctance to, hire American Africans as firefighters because how the firefighters work. It's a unique arrangement, a unique working condition. We work a day on and off 2 days. So
right.
We live in the firehouse. And they didn't want us breaking up that country club atmosphere that they had created for themselves. See?
Okay.
And that's why nepotism and cronyism is very big in the fire service. And so what you talked about earlier in terms of discriminatory practice, harassment, and so forth, that's systemic within the fire service even to this day.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you were on, did you have to address some of that with some of the command or just even other workers just being harassed? How did you deal with those type of things?
Well, I was always outspoken. I was the president of the Black Firefighters Association.
Okay.
Not only locally, but eventually I was president nationally. So I was always advocating for us to get on the job, to be maintained on the job, and to be promoted. You know, so, I consistently brought to the attention, of any discriminatory practices or harassment or any mistreatment or whatever.
Well, I'm sure I'm pretty sure we know a lot of people in common. I was going to mention Mark Wade. He was there. I don't know if he what was the conditions that he left. I don't think he stayed to like a full retirement, but he was there for a number of years. I don't know if he got hurt on the job or something like that.
Right, he went off on duty disability.
Okay.
But he had a couple of incidents.
Mm-hmm. And no, I guess
he had a couple of incidents.
And so I just want to think about the fairness, you know, how you feel about certain things, because this is some of the talk. And so I can't say this for sure because I'm not a firefighter. I've seen them when they went into buildings where, you know, there was a suspect of a fire and tearing down parts of the wall and so forth and this and that. And I don't have their knowledge of how to deal with fires and what they're specifically looking for when they're tearing the walls down. And but sometimes that was said that a lot of times when they were backing up the police in situations, and if there was a suspect of some term of some type of fire or something or whatever, that they would do more damage on a house to someone that more than likely probably didn't have any homeowner's insurance or whatever. And I mean, have you noticed anything like that where they would purposely damage somebody's house? I mean, or you heard that? I mean, I've heard stories like that, but I can tell you what police have done because I was there on the scene and I've been around those people and I've witnessed that. But as a firefighter, you know, that's a different story for me.
Right. And I would say that there's a lot in the overhaul process. Once the fire is out in the overhaul process, sometimes firefighters have been overzealous in overhauling. Basically, I mean, I can remember a few incidents where they just literally just threw everything out the window, everything out the door. All the things that those people owned didn't take a moment to see if this could be salvaged, if that could be salvaged.
Right.
Just threw it all out. Like, this stuff is nothing. You know, we got to understand that within a society, there's a total disregard for us as you know, American African people. And so, unfortunately, it's the same way with the fire department. In fact, the history of the fire department is very racist in its nature because the fire department was one of the last public works jobs that we as people could access simply because of your working arrangement. Yeah, because, you know, you live in a firehouse. You work one day and off two, or you work one, off two, off three, whatever.
Sure.
You live in the firehouse, and they didn't want to, you know, I was talking to some brothers about one of the first American-African firefighters in the city of Milwaukee, William Curry. William Curry was a very intelligent brother. You know, I think he had a degree. His wife, there's a woman here in Milwaukee, she's very noted, Val Phillips. Because Val Phillips was a Secretary of State. She was an alder person. She led open housing marches. And so for Val Phillips, you know, she was a street named after Val, was a dynamic woman.
Right.
He married her sister. He married Val Phillips' sister. You know, and they eventually, he took a lot of stuff, just a lot of bull from the fire department. They threw a mattress in a corner. They gave him a cup and a plate and a spoon, you know. And he took it. And he said, I'll take this until the next one comes along, which was about 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he took a lot of discrimination, humiliation, grief, you know. And we had him at our national convention here in Milwaukee in 1992, Mr. William Curry. And he, you know, he had the opportunity to tell his story, and he was interviewed on TV, you know. But that's the history of the fire service. That's the history. You know, affirmative action opened up the fire service across this country to us, to people of color, and even women. Affirmative action did away with a lot of things. It did away with height requirements. So somebody who was like 5'7" or even shorter could now be a firefighter, you know. So not only did it break those barriers of so-called color, but it also broke a lot of other so-called barriers, you know. And then, of course, women had the opportunity to get on to be firefighters, you know. So, you know, fire service in itself is very discriminatory. And then just like Reconstruction after the enslavement years lasted only about 10 years, so did affirmative action. Lasted only about 10 years. And once it was over, they went back to hiring as they had done in the past. That's why you see some cities who have a sizable number of American Africans as well as other people, Latinos, Native Americans, and so forth. But yet, the fire department is, you know, 80%, 90% white male.
Right.
Because, they, you know, and see, nepotism and cronyism is huge in the fire service. It's almost like somebody who's a firefighter, you know, from a few generations ago can bequeath a seat for his grandson, his great-grandson.
Right.
You know, simply because he was a firefighter.
Right.
And it's just that serious, you know. Just that serious.
And, you know, it's the same way with law enforcement. But, you know, like I said, it's such a relationship. And there was an incident, and when I'm talking, you know, first responders, you know, if, let's see, we started kind of saving manpower. If there's a call of a person has some injury issue or whatever, you know, the fire department would go over there and talk to the person versus the police, because we used to run over there as well and then, you know, meet the fire department. And sometimes we would be there just to assist, just because somebody might get out of control, and that's not their job to try to wrestle and fight with somebody when they need help or whatever the situation might turn bad or something like that. But I guess what I'm seeing now, actually, I've seen it earlier, but, you know, there's just been a number of things where first responders, there was a firefighter in New York that kicked a young man in the head. He was already down on the ground, laying down, and there was they got a call that somebody was lighting matches or something like this. And this person was mentally challenged. He was laying on the ground, and I think a 22-year-old white male. And the firefighter was a white male. And actually, he was a martial artist. And he started talking to the guy and told the guy, you know, to just stay on the ground, not to get up. And the guy was laying in a prone position, and then he sat up. And this was, you know, back in September. And when he sat up, this firefighter kicked him in the head and then punched him a couple times. He ended up with some fractures. There was a police officer that was on the scene that witnessed the whole thing, because they're showing the video of this, you know, when they played this thing back. And you heard the police officer say the subject just attacked the firefighter. You know, now that clearly didn't happen, and the firefighter had kicked him in the head and punched him a couple times. But again, you have that relationship where, you know, if I don't do it, you do it. And sometimes, you know, we generally know who these people, who generally call them, we say MOs, are people in need of mental observation and so forth, that we run into all the time, and we kind of know their status. You know, and so what do you, you know, think about things like that that happen? I mean, did you see people abuse people
myself,
on the job?
You know, I really haven't seen firefighters. I haven't seen members of the fire department. At least I'm definitely not questioning it does not happen or could happen,
right.
But I haven't seen it in my professional career of over 30 years. You know, of a firefighter.
Wow.
You know, I've seen us restrain people or try to restrain people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, you know, when we go on a call, you know, police won't be involved if somebody who's
right.
really having a diabetic situation, and, you know, and he's
sure.
fighting with us and so forth until we can get that Drexel in him, you know, or her. Then they kind of chill out. But I have not seen that. You know, I definitely believe that it happens because there's a lot of people with the same mentality on the fire department, police
right.
department, and in society. And in society, you know, and where some people just don't have the patience, you know, to deal with people who are going through some stuff, you know, don't show them the respect or, you know, and that's just a fact, sadly.
Well, what do you think about, you know, you had the fire department and the police department in New York and, I mean, not New York, Minnesota, I'm sorry. And they were very upset about the outcome of the George Floyd incident and the protesters and so forth. And one of the things that happened was some of the firefighters, they had kind of wrote that the department management have softened up because they wanted to use the water hoses on protesters. And that's what they were complaining about. And then you had some with the fire department and then the police officers, and they have this recorded, so the federal, the feds are investigating this. So now the Minnesota Police Department are being investigated because when the protesters were protesting after the George Floyd incident, these were peaceful protests, and they were using rubber and wooden bullets, and they were using tear gas, and they were hitting with batons. Now, these were people that were peaceful. And so they were doing that, and that was videotaped. But they wanted to have the fire department standing by and assist them. But, again, I don't think their command would allow them to, you know, use the hoses the way, you know, they were hoping.
I would hope not.
Could. Yeah,
I would.
But,
hope
I mean, you
not.
Know, it is. But what do you think? I mean, you know, this is that something you think that could happen again? I mean, that was
of course it could.
60,
yeah.
But
yeah.
And what
yes,
justification?
It could, but
I mean, is that a good use of trying
of
to deter people using that hose?
No, but it almost happened in Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm.
I got wind of it at a certain incident. Where some guy got loose. He was up on a porch, and they were talking about getting a hose out and spraying a hose at it. Well, actually, a straight stream, you know.
Okay.
Hitting me with a hose. And I'm so glad they didn't do that. And I told the chief that. I said, man, do you know what that looks like? Do you know how that is, that you would use a hose to try to subdue a patient instead of just having
right.
the patient to get him off that ledge or whatever. I'm just so glad they didn't do that. But it has happened.
Mm.
It
yeah.
has happened. You know, once again, the fire service as well as the police department, the mentality of the people, that's still there. You know,
right.
that's still there. Just like you said, you know, to break up peaceful protests, you've seen how the police have behaved. You know,
mm-hmm.
so let's not fool ourselves and talk about this is a different time. Now, I don't
right.
know about Minneapolis, you know, but to me, the evidence is right there.
Right.
You know, the guy kneeled on George,
yep.
You know, his neck for nine and a half minutes, you know. Kneeling on George Floyd's neck over 9.5 minutes. The evidence is there. They were constantly saying to him, hey, you can't be, he didn't give a damn.
Now, I don't know in that situation. I mean, they show the officers, but if there's a wider screen and stuff like that, because generally when there's certain situations, the first responders, you know, are generally standing by, especially when we think that there's going to be an incident where somebody could be hurt. Even we could be hurt. And a lot of times,
right.
even when I know there were times when, you know, we went to strike situations and so forth, and we had an ambulance, a fire department personnel standing
sure.
by in the area because
sure.
somebody could be hurt, and it might be an officer or something like that. And
right.
so I'm wondering, because most people know what a blood choke is, and they, you know, especially there was a first responder. There was a lady that was a first responder, and she was made a comment that, hey, you know, that's what you call a blood choke. And she told that officer that when he was kneeling on him. And then there was
mm-hmm.
another guy that was a black male. He was an MMA fighter, and he basically said the same thing. But nobody did anything, you know. So you got the other officers just kind of standing around watching, and as this man is agonizing and dying. And, you know, and then his last words basically is calling for his mother, who is already deceased. And so you're talking about that, and that was one of the comments that the fire department, the black firefighters of New York made a complaint about, because when they were teasing and talking about George Floyd, they talked about him crying, his last words crying out for his mother. So they made jokes about that. And so the black firefighters were, you know, they didn't like that again. And so you had several officers get suspended for a couple of days, and I think one of the harshest penalties, someone was suspended for 6 months. And so, I mean, but, you know, that, and then one of the other comments that they made, you know, the firefighters, these are first responders, and they were like, well, you know, I really envy being a police officer because you can legally go around killing black children. And so that was one of the other comments that they had put out there. And so when you think about things like that, and I know how first responders are trained, you know, because we would sometimes have to train together sometimes, especially when we had the Columbine incidents, and they talked about how people would respond, and if we have mass casualties and so forth, you know, how we're going to move with the tech team and how the fire department is going to move with us. Because at one point they were even talking about, well, some people wanted to arm firefighters. I don't know if you guys ever went through that kind of talk from within your department.
Well, I've been gone for quite a few years. I've been gone since 06, and nothing like that, you know, ever came up. In fact, the incident I mentioned earlier about the fire hose being used, I was already retired, but because I'm, you know, former past president of the association, and because I've always and always will advocate for us being on the job and retained and promoted on the job and having good working conditions, that, you know, that's why I called the chief of the department and had a audience with him to, you know, make sure that shouldn't even be an option. You know, we shouldn't even think about using a fire hose and then let alone arming firefighters. You know, I understand there are some firefighters that work in some really bad neighborhoods.
Right.
I understand that. But I still think, to some degree, if the firefighters had not alienated themselves from the community, that
right.
the community still has some respect for firefighters and the job that we do, you know, because when you call 911, you want help right now, and the fire
right.
department comes there right away to help. We're not going to judge your house, how you look. We're not going to judge anything. We're going to come in to find out what is the problem, how can we help, you know, what do we have to do? So...
Well,
but,
we're coming to the top of the hour, so I'm going to we'll take a break, and then I want to come back because I got some questions I want to ask you about, you know, first responders in regards to, you know, are you able as a retired officer, and you had rank as well. You weren't just a firefighter. Were you a command officer as well?
No, I was the captain. Of the company officer.
Oh, captain. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So I would think that sometimes, you know, you would be able to be that voice of reason with your experience and be able to, you know, give some insight or even have a relationship with some of the new black officers, firefighters that are on the job now. So that's something I want to, some questions I want to ask you when we come back. So we're getting ready to go to break. We're going to break for a couple minutes, and we'll be right back as soon as I find my song. Okay, there it is.
Okay.
Okay.
Sets me off to a full-on child. Yes, he does. The way you speak and tease knocks me
You are listening to Warriors Way Radio, where their motto is continuing the fight. Your host is Brother Kwasi Kraft. Warriors Way Radio is an affiliate of the Sankofa Historical Society, which is a part of the Black Reality Think Tank. And they are operating on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Check them out. Email them at warriorsway101@gmail.com. All of our programs are archived. Just go to www.blogtalkradio.com. Go to the search portal. Put in the Sankofa Historical Society and check out any of our programs that are there. They air every Thursday evening at 6 o'clock. Warriors Way Radio. Continuing the fight.
Hold up, family. We are back. Warriors Way Radio, continuing to fight. We have a special guest, Brother Oshi, former captain with the Milwaukee Fire Department. And so we'll get his responses and insight on some of the things that's going on and the do's and don'ts and what it's supposed to look like, you know, in the fire department. I do see that we have Sister Dee Dee. You're online. I was wanting to ask you if you're there by chance. Have you had an incident or a situation where you had to call first responders, fire department, police, you know? Or is there anything you'd like to share with us? Any comments, questions? Or are you just listening?
I apologize.
Okay.
No problem. I was muted.
Okay.
Yes, I did have to call a few times while my son.
Fire department?
Yes. Well, you know, when you call 911, as the young man said, the fire department comes out. I'm kind of glad they came out and the police. I wouldn't want them to hurt or kill my son.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because a lot of times when he's coming out of his seizure, you know, he kind of acts out or he's real confused. But anyway, I must say they were very, very kind. And one of them, he was an older gentleman, very compassionate-like. And, I was shocked, but very, very kind.
Well, that's always good to hear. And,
how they came, yes, how they came. And assist the situation, how they were talking to my son. You know, they wasn't hollering and screaming and getting smart and just saying, you know, little, you know, making little nasty comments or whatever. I mean, they were right on it. You know, got the oxygen on. I mean, I was, like I said, I was very appreciative, I tell you that. And it was something kind of different, I tell you that.
Well, you know, that is exactly how it should be, I think, all the time. But, you know, like, we're just seeing the difference. So we shouldn't be shocked when they treat us nice, you know. But we just don't know what we're going to get sometimes, you know.
That's
and,
right.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that in itself makes it scary when we call. Because, like I said, there are first responders and, you know, police and fire, you know, we try to work together a lot of times. And I know there's been a few times where I had to put a firefighter in check because they were being a little too aggressive with somebody. And I said, look, I'll handle this. You know,
Can I just say one more thing?
Go ahead.
Can I just say one more thing? You know, because I have to call them several times. The only thing I can say is it's sad when you don't see none of us. that's what's kind of, you know, that's kind of bothersome sometimes. I mean, I know people,
sure.
you know, people probably saying, well, who cares as long as somebody come and help you or come. True
right.
enough, right. You okay, but still, see your own, you know, put you at ease too sometimes. And then again, I don't know, but, and then again, even for our younger people coming up, you know, to
mm-hmm.
see, oh, what, black firefighter. Might make him want to
right.
be one, or it might make
right.
them want to do. You know, we can't tell them to go and be anything when they don't see none of us, doctors, lawyers,
right.
nurses. So, okay, I just wanted to skip that out. Thank you, Brother Quasi.
No, I appreciate you. Thank you. Hey, so Brother Osi.
Yeah. Love their comment.
Well, you heard Sister Didi, you know, she had the call, you know, her son was in need, and she called 911. That's, you know, those are the things that you respond to.
Yeah.
I mean, you guys are trained, you know, to deal with just general first aid. You know, does it go be, I mean, are you guys trying to get it a little more extensive? Because am I right? Because
no.
With,
let me
you
say
guys,
that.
All right, one level.
The first
do you
responders,
have
the first responders are all in today's fire service, particularly in Milwaukee. They're all
okay.
EMTs. They're all EMTs, so they can come and give you the immediate care. Now, if the
uh-huh.
situation calls for it, then the paramedics come. Paramedics are advanced. They can give you
right.
drugs. You know.
Okay.
And so. I like what she said, because usually that's what happens more times than not, that the firefighters
right.
will come and show some respect to you, your home, and so forth, usually. I ain't saying that's something that happens all the time, because it is not, but usually that's what happens. I know that the guys that worked with me, I always told them that we're going to treat our customers, we're going to treat our citizens like it was, we're going to treat them like it's at 3 a.m., as if it was 3 p.m. We're going to give them
okay.
a level of care, of respect, and good service. You know, we're going to respect their home. We're not going to put our first aid kit on top of their cocktail table, knowing where that thing has been, you know. So, I mean, you know,
right.
that's it. Just have some, you know, level of respect for the people in their home.
You know, I'm wondering about something, and I don't – you said you left – in 2008 or you were going before, way before. Oh, okay. Then I think this was 2005, or it could have been right around 2006. But this is the Frank Jude situation,
right?
If you recall
well.
That.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and Nicole Martinez, she used to be a good friend of mine. She used to ride with me as an auxiliary when I was in Cudahy, and she wanted to become an officer so bad. And she took the test in Milwaukee, and she got on with the Milwaukee Police Department. And I knew Andrew Sprangler, those guys, because they used to train at Adrian Serrano's gym, fighting and stuff like that, you know, mixed martial arts. And, you know, and the Frank Jude, I actually knew of him because he went to the church I used to go to years ago. And so when that situation took place, you know, after all was said and done, you know, they beat him up really bad. And, you know, Andrew Sprangler complained and said that, you know, he stole my badge. So that's why we, you know, had to do what we did and so forth. But there was an ambulance pulled me on the scene. And the officers, and I don't know which officers, because these were like about 30 officers, but they were off duty. And they basically said, we don't need an ambulance. Now, I know that how that works, whereas, I mean, they can't deny him an ambulance. He would have to sign off and say, I don't need an ambulance. But in the condition he's in, I wouldn't think that he's, you know, that's like a chapter 51. There's no way that he can make a rational decision for his care in the condition that he was. So long and short of it, Nicole Martinez showed up on the scene. And she ended up taking Frank Jude to the hospital in her squad car. And so she got in trouble for that by Haggerty, because Haggerty was the chief at the time. She got suspended. And then when she went back to work, she got death threats and so forth. They were going to back her up on the streets. And long and short of it, she resigned on a medical disability. I'm just wondering how that happens, you know, because when somebody is injured like that, and from my understanding, the ambulance was on the scene, and how is it that they leave, and, you know, in the condition that this guy, both of his eyes were closed, nose broken, and he had multiple fractures to his face. So I don't understand that. You know, but again, I wasn't privy to that situation, and but I know in our case, you know, if we told the ambulance to leave this, that, or whatever, and stuff like that, they're going to leave based if we say that we got it for whatever reason. It's not a medical issue, and it's a safety other kind of thing, and we're going to deal with that. And we, you know, but outside of that, I don't know what happened there. I don't know if you have some insight to that.
Well, the only thing I'm thinking about is, number one, is how can the police call off medical services, you know? And obviously, in fact, weren't those guys off duty?
Yeah, they were off duty. And so I guess here's the thing that I'm thinking. I'm thinking because, you know, unless it was like a bail ambulance or something like that, I don't know. You know,
well, more than likely,
and,
that's who,
you know,
more than likely that's who it is, because in Milwaukee, I'm not sure now because I've been gone a while. When there is a emergency medical, you're going to get the nearest fire company.
Okay,
and if it's serious, you're going to get the paramedics, but the nearest fire company and usually a private will kind of trail that, so they could be on the scene, you know, simultaneously with the fire company to give immediate first aid, and so unless they beat him up so bad and they knew it, they were going to deny him medical care. Hence, the young lady, the female police officer, transported him herself in her squad car.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And to me, that should open up a whole another discussion about what happened at that scene. And to me, heads should have been rolling.
Mm-hmm. And see, enough of discussion that they clearly didn't want to have because they didn't do that. And the simple fact that she got death threats because she reported the incident, and all she did was take him to the hospital. And, you know, and I think that, you know, it's like one of the things is that, you know, as officers and, you know, other first responders, EMTs, we develop a relationship and a rapport because we see them on a regular basis on these calls from day to day. And whether we're in uniform or out of uniform, and if we say something, because they know that we're basically their backup if something does happen, because sometimes, you know, you get somebody and you're a little combative. Well, one of us arrives in the back of the ambulance with them. Why do you take them to the hospital, you know? And the squad will follow. But, you know, so they value our whatever decision or whatever statements we may make at that time. And I'm just thinking that's what happened. I don't know, but I'm just saying that's what I'm thinking happened. And that's why, because she knows that that's a violation, because you don't want to put somebody that battered and beat in your squad car.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
That's not your responsibility, you know, and you're not trained to deal with somebody like that. And you, that's got to be by the ambulance. So for the ambulance to leave, because they were apparently they were there, and were they intimidated by all the cops that were there, and they were, you know, it was more of a cover up kind of thing. We don't want you to you know, we don't want this thing to go out, because I think this happened in November. And this didn't hit the papers until February or maybe March, because Andrew Springer had fought in the Tough Man, the Waukesha Tough Man, and I wrapped his hands for the fight. And he knew this thing was coming out, and he said, Horace, don't tell anybody I'm fighting. And I said, Copper's fighting this all the time. What's the big deal? Well, the big deal was he understood that he would have probably been charged with an enhanced penalty if they knew he was a trained martial artist along with everything else. Because, you know, there were so many of them that jumped on Frank Jew at that party. And, I mean, because you can go back and you can Google and look at his face and see him the day that he was in the hospital. Both eyes are closed. Both of his jaws are swollen. His nose is crooked. And so I'm just, you know, a person, you know, they just can't make rational decisions, you know, to sign off on something like that, you know, because that's what we generally have to do if a person is refusing treatment. Or sometimes, you know, they don't sign off because they're, you know, being combative, and we just write that down as refused. And I don't know. That could have been the case as well, you know.
Well,
but I was just looking at that, and, you know, and that's troublesome because, like I said, I know that first responders, they do a pretty good job most of the time. I've only had to check somebody a couple times just because sometimes people take advantage of people. And usually, you know, they get rid of them, but for whatever reason, they're a good buddy, drinking buddy, whatever, and something like that, and, you know,
right,
they keep these
right.
guys. You know, and yeah. that's part of that union thing where, you know you got a bad apple, but you keep them. Nobody wants to work on them, work with them. I don't want to be on the roof with this guy because he's not going to be able to save me, this and that. You hear that kind of conversation a lot. You know, and the standards have changed so much from when you were on and when, you know, whereas guys don't have to, you know, this fitness level and everything, that's totally irrelevant now. And so I don't know if that's something that might play into the mind of some of the people that are working the job now, because, you know, they're not fit, but you guys have so much time on your, you know, that you, like you said, you can work 1 or 2 days and stuff and be off for 3 days.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, it's such a luxury, but again, the job, you know, when you do have to do what you do, I mean, it can be, you know, you can lose your life just like that. And then the other hand, you know, when you made a comment about firefighters working in bad neighborhoods and stuff like that, but one of the things I don't rarely hear about is firefighters being attacked. And so in your years of experience,
right, that's what I'm saying. The firefighters try to develop, at least they should always, no matter what neighborhood it is in, a quote good neighborhood or a quote bad neighborhood, you develop a good rapport with your neighbors. You get out to know them.
Right.
You go to some of the places like you and fire inspection or something like that, because, you know, you're there to help. You're not to judge. You're not there to judge. You're not there to be critical or anything like that. Only thing you're there to do is to help. When they dial 911 and whatever the situation is, an asthma attack, a heart attack, bleeding, an accident, whatever it is, you coming there to mitigate the situation, and you don't give a damn about anything else.
You know, one of the things that I see, you know, and it happens with police as well, but you guys become the heroes. You know, you just save this person, you know, and sometimes people, you know, they develop a crush on you. You know, they're sending flowers, love letters, stopping by the station. It happens. A lot of people don't really realize that, but that happens too. And so I was thinking, and then sometimes, you know, this is another situation where we've had firefighters where they have relationships with people, you know, that might be married. And, you know, and the husband maybe finds out. And, you know, we had that shot at the fire station on, was that Capitol a couple years ago, about 3-4 years ago?
I don't
know if
wow.
you recall that.
No,
yeah, somebody
I don't.
Shot. Yeah, they shot in shot at the firehouse.
Yes, I remember that.
At Capitol.
Yeah, I remember.
And,
that.
And I said, you know, and people, and it was on the news, and people like, now who would do that to a first responder? They're there to help, you know. No, they somebody did that because somebody was fooling around with somebody's wife. You know, that's people there. They know that goes on. It's a common thing.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to make. I mean, it happens in all professions. It happens in all.
It does.
But I'm just saying, you know, and like I said, they weren't trying to hit anybody. They were just putting a message out there, and that's what it was, you know. And so the person that was doing what they're, you know, doing and stuff, they know the message was out there. You know, that's just
right.
Something that happens. But, again, you get people that, you know, like the job is, you know, it can be very, I mean, it's, you know, life changing from day to day, from moment to moment. And so you have to be, you know, do you guys go through some psychological training, you know, like with police, you know, as far as evaluation? I think police officers should be evaluated every couple of years, or especially after certain incidents
well,
and so forth.
Let me say this. Years ago, even before I came on the job, the idea of a firefighter was, he's macho. Nothing bothers him. He's, you know, he can do anything. He does everything and so forth. Well, you know, when you see death, when you see
right.
babies burnt up, and you see, you know,
right.
people decapitated and all these other horrors that you can see,
mm-hmm.
back then, you're just supposed to take that. You know, let it just something that happened. It's part of your job. Go home and have a good day. Then they begin to realize that seeing this deep trauma all the time, it will have an effect on you.
Mm-hmm.
And so back in the 80s, they began to have debriefings and defusings and other, and then, of course, the EAP program, asking guys that if you really need help, you know. Now, even at that time, because some guys, well, I don't need that, you know. Shoot,
mm-hmm.
I got Jack Daniels. I don't need that.
Right.
You know. You know, but to me, you may need that. You
yeah.
may need to talk to somebody, because particularly as firefighters, we see everything.
Yeah.
You know, we see, I mean, in my career of 30 years, I've seen it all.
Yeah.
And it's mm-hmm. a lot of it's really sad, you know, but thank God, you know, I was able to do my job, and I retired, and I'm fine. But there are
yeah.
some who, you know, it took a toll.
Yeah.
You know, in fact, both occupations, fire and police, there's a high suicide rate.
Yeah.
For both occupations. In mm-hmm. fact, I think in my 30 years, I think there's been 10 suicides on the Milwaukee Fire Department. Just in that
mm.
time frame. Yeah.
I know I did a report and I looked. I know that law enforcement, police have the highest rate of suicide, but fire
okay.
department has the highest rate of PTSD, you know,
mm-hmm.
they were showing. And that, you know, a lot of people don't understand that aspect of things, but I think that if people come to, like you said, a lot of people are macho. They don't want to get help when they need help. And I'm sure I was probably one of those people. I remember I had a car accident. The girl that was killed, I saw her playing a basketball game, high school basketball game. And she was in the car. Somebody was drunk. And I'm on the scene, and I'm walking around, and I'm seeing one body's out of the car, flew out this here and stuff, and I'm, you know, I'm taking measurements, doing this and that, and I step on something, and, you know, and I kind of slip, and, you know, I almost fall down. I catch myself, and I look down at my shoe, and I look, and I see this girl, and I'm like, I just stepped on the brain, part of the brain.
Oh, man, yeah.
And it just tore me up, and my command officer shows up on the scene, and I don't want to wear these shoes anymore. And I don't want to, you know, and I'm just, and he looked at me like, you know, you got to do this. And he just started barking orders at me and stuff like that. And, you know, and I just shook it off and just did what I needed to do. But I was just kind of stone-faced about everything. And you know, and I wasn't a young guy on the job. You know, I had over 15 years on the job at this point and stuff like that. And I've seen a lot of bad things, but at the same time, you know, it's, you know, like I said, things, it rides you a different way. And, you know, sometimes you hold on to it. So when you think about a lot of the issues that go on, but, you know, this racial stuff, I mean, that's a different animal altogether. You know, where people are just being mean and vicious to somebody just because they look different, and more likely than not, it's black people that are targeted. You know, and have you had to, on your time on the job, have you witnessed even police officers sometimes? You know, a lot of times, you know, they're being a little too rough. Have you ever maybe reported or thought about reporting an officer?
Yeah, I have.
I sure do appreciate that.
We had a situation totally under control, and police come in, and they exacerbate the tension.
Yeah.
And I'm like, man, you know? And so, in fact, the guy, we were giving him vitals, and they jump up. I mean, they're going around into this guy's place. Said, "What y'all doing?" And then next thing you know, they're tussling. Then I grab him, you know, and then the police officer reaches for his gun, you know. So we had the situation totally under control, and these two big dudes, little thug-ass cops, they come in and just thinking they all bad. Well, I had to write it up. Nothing happened to me. But I wrote it up basically, you know, how they came and what their attitude was like and why the situation escalated to that kind of situation, you know?
You know, I've witnessed that myself many a times where, you know, where we have a situation control and then another command officer comes and he wants to enforce his style of justice on that person. And, you know, and it changes things. So now we got to create a situation where we can justify he did what he did for the right reasons, and we couldn't do it, not be honest. So myself and other officers, we started writing up some of our command officers.
Great.
And later on that turned and that went against me because it was like, you know, I was the only black officer, so, you know, they can talk to the other guys and, you know, we get you guys doing what you do, but we're supposed to be a family and, you know, but I was never part of that family. They had me thinking I was, you know, because we're all blue, that kind of thing and stuff like that. But, you know, that's just words and, you know, and all that other kind of stuff. We already know that. But it is just something, you know, that, it is so common that we have a situation, like you said, under control, and somebody will go in there and they will blow this thing up. And so when you look at all the money that's being paid out yearly, you know, you have $400,000 in lawsuits from the police department in the United States last year for racial incidents, just racial incidents.
Right.
$400,000 $400 million.
That's what I say. I was going to say.
And that's taxpayer money.
That.
Huh? Yeah.
And that's right. It's taxpayer money.
Yeah.
You know?
And so a lot
our taxes
people,
paid for the foolishness that, that police. In fact, it should be some way that when police officers found that they have behaved this way, that somehow they could be fined as well. Their pension could be, you know, deducted, whatever the case may be, aside from being terminated.
Hmm.
Or they don't get a pension.
Well, you know, I would love to see something like that, but I'm just wondering, you know, this power thing and how people transfer. You get some rotten officers, and they get in trouble in the police department, but because they work for the city and they want to decide to transfer over and be a firefighter. Have you gotten rid of guys? I mean, because I know tons of officers that were had some issues and guys didn't like working with them, and they're firefighters. And they're going to, and some of them have retired, close to retiring, and some of them have retired as firefighters. But that transfer, that change, you know, are you part or have you been part of that situation where you could at least be part of that evaluation when they look at candidates and stuff? Because have you seen that shift where, you know, you got a lot of people that were former police officers and now they're firefighters?
No,
and that happened
a lot
when Chief Jones came in.
Yeah. No, we didn't engage in anything like that, not the fire department itself, no.
Mm-hmm. And so, and then the other thing I was going to ask, because I was also part of the Black Police Association, and you said you're with the fire department. Do you engage with some of these current firefighters now in, you know, to show them some type of support? Because a lot of the people that are in command positions, you know, don't look like them and they're not judged, I don't think, fairly and stuff, because I know how it's done, you know, in my day and my conversations with other people. And so I'm just wondering, you know, what the numbers look like. And do you have a chance to kind of try to go in there and impact their lives? Do they call you in for maybe an in-service or be part of a situation? Or is that a separate thing that you do, or do are you blocked by the union? If you guys do what you do, you know, you just have to invite these recruits or firefighters to come get some insight from you, you know, some discussions, you know, to handle some grievances and so forth.
Well, I'm not sure what happens with the Milwaukee Brotherhood of Firefighters today or any other organization, Black Firefighters organization. I know that we are not as effective as we once were. We're not as strong an advocate as we used to be.
Mm. What's stopping that? I mean, is there something? I mean, I know, is Dwayne Smoot, do you know who he is?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And, yeah, and,
no,
I knew,
no,
and we grew up together. Smoot
hasn't been the president in quite a few years either. Eric Crowcroft, who's also on the Fire Police Commission, he has been the president, and Anthony Lewis is the current president. But the organization itself, not just Milwaukee Brotherhood of Firefighters, but the International Association of Black Professional Firefighters, you know, nationwide, our organization is not as strong as it once was, and it definitely still needs to be. But many people who get the job think they got the job on their own, and their attitude is, I got mine, you get yours, you know.
Right.
And that if there is discrimination, it don't affect me.
Right. Well, you know, I think that we're paralleling each other with the situation, because with the police department, they have the new League of Martin. And and so I think, what's his name? Troy Johnson. I think he's the president. He's the president, the new president with them. And, you know, back in the day, it was Leonard Wells. And I remember when I had an incident in Cudahy, and the late Leonard Wells, and he came and he told me that, look, we don't have the money and the resources that we used to have. And this was back, you know, in the early 2000s. And but what he said that he could do, because I also talked with the NAACP, and they could, you know, like I said, they lost credibility, and so they had to be really careful as far as when they picked and choose to help somebody. And so basically what they did was they had Leonard set me up with a police officer that was kind of being bullied and so forth, going through a lot of the same things that I was going through, and just have him talk to me just to kind of be a voice for me and make sure I don't do anything foolish, you know, because, you know, that's something that just happens sometimes. You know, people make these mistakes. Or they go through something and, you know, abuse can, I mean, everybody doesn't handle it, you know, in the best of ways, you know. And I certainly wouldn't try to push anybody, and especially people that are wearing guns every day when they're in the hips anyway. You know, it's just, I think, kind of foolish, you know. But this is how bold and selfless and careless these police are when they do the things that they do, because, you know, it's almost like they feel that they're on that plantation, that they can do whatever they want to you, and you're not even going to raise a finger.
Right.
You know, so when you look at these situations, and so I'm just like, how do we change it so that we can let people know that we can be assistance to them? And I'm talking about other officers. You know, I think that union is probably the biggest enemy, because they keep they protect a lot of people that shouldn't be around. And then these people, when they leave with a nest egg for the rest of their life.
Right.
That pension.
Yep.
You know, and these are people that are just so troubled.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. It's just a scary situation. I talked about the New York, the women, you know, like I said, they got that $100 million lawsuit. Here's one of the ladies, her husband had to back her up at the station. One of the guys came in with a AK-47 and roll call, and he was pointing it around, and she had made some complaints. And so she was targeted. And one of the things they were saying about, you know, these black police women, that they made these complaints because the men were, you know, touching them, you know, grabbing them. Grab one lady, just grabbed her butt and squalled on it. And then when she turned, he just started grinning at her, urinating in the car in a bottle with another female copper. And these are not just regular police officers. These are command officers too, a sergeant and a lieutenant, you know, and they went, you know, through the normal process, but none of that, you know, none of their complaints were being taken serious. And so when you got, and this is today, you got police officers, women from police officers, this is in Washington, D.C., that are dealing with this, and I think one of the ladies have retired since. And some of the other women are still on the department, still going through this abuse. And the statement that they made is, you know, you're just dealing with angry black women. And then, you know, you got the standard little, well, we on this police department don't tolerate racism or harassment of any kind. And so this will be investigated. And so you get that blanket statement that everybody makes when these things happen. And it just seems to never turn out, you know. Well, I'll put it this way. I won't say turn out, because you may win a lawsuit and so forth, but it still doesn't change what they're doing.
It will not change the culture. Individuals win lawsuits, but the culture maintains itself, because that's what happens in the dominant society.
Mm-hmm.
see, the society itself is racist, is bigoted, is mean-spirited. That's what it is itself. Is it as systemic as it was in the 1800s? No, it's not. But is it still very racist? Is it still segregated? Is it still, you know, yeah. I mean, you know, once again, for us as American Africans, we are job seekers. We are not job
right.
givers.
Right.
And the persons who we seek jobs from can't stand our ass. That's a fact.
Right, right.
And so, therefore, we don't get the kinds of jobs that will be family-sustaining as often as we should. And, therefore, we're out. And so, to me, that's why the push to get more of us on the fire department, police department, and in city government should be maintained
mm-hmm.
because why? We're taxpayers. Private industry has always done what it wants to do. If a private company
right.
wants to employ some brothers and sisters, thank you, so be it. But the city or the county or whatever, you know, they should be hiring some of us within numbers that are proportional to our population. It's only right because we're taxpayers, and our taxes pay for those services.
But, you know, I think that one of the reasons that they don't do that is they worry about the numbers and the numbers, because if you increase the numbers, you increase voting power. And so once people start voting, now you change the power of what the union can do. And they certainly don't want to change that. You know, it's just like the police department when they were looking to make some changes here and there. And I know the New League of Martin, they were in support of Morales when he was chief, and then all of a sudden he flipped the script, and he's backing up Trump, and he's at this in the union, and now the police union is backing up Trump, and they're anti, you know, defunding the police.
I don't know about the police union nationally. But I know about the firefighter union nationally. The firefighter union nationally has always backed Democrats. They've always backed Democrats. But the locals have always been conservative and supported Republicans. The firefighters, local, you know, they've always supported. So, I mean, I've ventured to say they were in serious support of definitely were in support of Scott Walker when he was governor because
yes.
he helped them break the residency. Because even before I came on the Milwaukee Fire Department in the mid-70s, the whites on the fire department did not want to live in the city.
Mm-hmm.
They did not want to live in it. They want the job. They want the promotions. They want the benefits, the vacations, the pension. But they don't want to live in the city. And so when Scott Walker did what he did, oh, what a blessing to them, you know.
Right.
And of course, along comes Donald Trump, which they love probably too, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been that kind of mentality.
Yeah. You know, I tell you, it's so tough when you have common sense people like you and myself when we want to do the good things, and we do it. We do it consistently on the job. I mean, because we wouldn't have it. We make a mistake on the job, we're going to be done. We're going to be out of there real quick. It is so different for us. You know, we've always said, you know, if a black person's got a job, you know, some people would always say, well, it's affirmative action. They got it. No, you basically have to be 2 to 3 times better than your white counterpart.
That's
now, they're not going to acknowledge that you're better or anything like that. You know, they're always going to try to make you feel that you're subservient and all this other. You're going to play that secondary role, but you know, physically, mentally, and on the job, as far as how you have to perform, you have to shine so far over them just to stay at the table.
Mm-hmm.
And so that in itself, that kind of mental stress, you know, because everybody gets tired. you know, and goes through some different things at different times, whether family life or, you know, things on your job or other things that may come up, you know, or some personal health issues, you know. But, you know, it's something that we have to deal with, but it's a war. It's a struggle, you know.
It is.
So, yeah. You know, I wish I could have made contact with Rich Holmes. I would have liked to did you ever get a chance to work, or have you worked with – I know you said you know him, but did you ever work with
right.
him?
Right. No, I worked – yes. I wasn't – I was in the same engine house he was at one time, and so I worked with him a few times, but we were not on the same shift together. So I did work with him.
Yeah. And I – you know, and I would you know, Rich told me about a few incidents that he had, and he straightened some people out right away, because Rich is just you know, you look at him, and he's just a very intimidating person and stuff like that. And some
yeah.
of these guys, you know, they get really big, and, you know, they're pumping all the time. And, you know, Rich did a little bit, but he was a fighter, too, and they found that out real quick. You know, a couple of times he said he had to spar with somebody to put him in check and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And but it's just something that we really have to do certain things, you know, just to try to work in a normal situation. It is just so difficult for us in so many situations and scenarios. So when I think about all the struggles of all these people, I couldn't even relate to what they're going through in New York, because it is a different beast there with the type of things that they do, the brutality that they do to the people, and that the fire department officials are just equally a part of that as the police officers are. You know, and so, you know, that in itself is scary when you think about first responders, because these are the people you call, and, you know, and I have so many people and friends, you know, where they're scared to call the police, you know, because it's like they don't know what's going to happen. And
right.
for the most part, and now you're starting to feel that with firefighters.
But that's, you know, that's true to some extent, that you don't know what's going to happen, because you heard around the country that when the cops were called, or when the emergency service was called, you know, the situation flipped. And those who called for help now become a victim, you know, through either a misunderstanding or through the negligence of the department, be it fire or police, you know, not handling the situation, you know, humanely and properly.
Right.
You know. Yeah. So,
yeah, that is too
you know,
bad.
I agree.
Well, yeah, well, I want to thank you for joining us today on the show. And you sure did give some insight on a lot of different things. And, you know, you guys do a wonderful job. And I think that's pretty consistent. And despite all the bad things that go on and the things that are said, for the most part, you just don't, even still, compared to law enforcement, you're just not getting a lot of the same negativeness from most first responders when in regards to EMTs and firefighters and stuff. It seems like they just have a little higher level of compassion, so to speak, for whatever reason. It just because you don't – go ahead.
No, I was just saying because, you know, number one, we've always – the fire department always understood that we're there to help. We're not there
right.
to enforce anything. We're not there to enforce the law. We're not there to find out who's guilty or who's innocent. You know, we're there
right.
to mitigate the situation. And so, you know, when they call, we appear on the scene, what's the problem? You know, and so we go from that perspective, and we don't judge. We don't, you know, look at somebody, where they're living, how they're living, what they have done, what they drank or what they took, you know. And, I mean, in fact, you know, I'm going to be honest with you, brother, for all those years that I was a firefighter coming upon those situations, my mindset was it was not for the grace of God, there go I, you know.
Mm.
That could be me, you know.
Yeah.
So I was
never
somebody who, you know, I always tried my best to, like I said, give a level of care and service as if it was 3 a.m. or 3 p.m. It didn't matter.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, I want to thank you again for joining us. And I thank our listeners and people that called in for listening to Warrior's Way, continuing the fight. Next week, we're going to deal with some cold case incidents in regards to how people that were, whatever incidents, there could have been homicides or, you know, there's a young lady that was victimized. She was a street person, but she was raped and murdered, and the person that did it is scheduled to be released in 2023, so they're looking to get that out. I'll afford some more information about that, but we're going to be talking about a number of incidents like that that's in the Milwaukee area, cold cases that were kind of muffed, and some of these people may be out in the public. So again, thank you for joining us on Warrior's Way Production, continuing the fight. We will be back Thursday, 6 p.m. next week. All right, thank you.
When the glory comes, it will be ours. It will be ours. Oh, one day, when the war is won, we will be sure.
The heavens, no man, no weapon formed against, yes, glory is destined. Everyday women and men become legends. Sins that go against our skin become blessings. The movement is a rhythm to us. Freedom is like religion to us. Justice is juxtaposition in us. Justice for all just ain't specific enough. One son died, the spirit is revisiting us. True and living, living in us. Resistance is us. That's why Rosa sat on the bus. That's why we walk through Ferguson with our hands up. When it go down, we woman and man up. They say stay down, and we stand up. Shots be on the ground, the camera panned up. King pointed to the mountaintop, and we ran up.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours. It will be ours. Oh,
woman and child. Even Jesus got his crown in front of a crowd. They march with the torch, we gon' run with it now. Never look back, we done gone hundreds of miles. From dark roads, heroes, to become a hero. Facing the league of justice, his power was the people. Enemy is lethal, a king became regal. Saw the face of Jim Crow under a bald ego. No one can win the war individually. It takes the wisdom of the elders and young people's energy. Welcome to the story we call victory. The coming of the Lord, my eyes have seen the glory.
One day, when the glory